Good morning. Thank you, everyone, for coming. It's a great, great amount of people and great energy today. I want to thank you as one of the Neely co-chairs. My name's Tammy Miller. I was asked to welcome everybody and just give you a few plugs about some Neely events, talk a little bit about Neely, and then we'll be able to hand it over to Wendy Margolin, one of our co-chairs, and start this morning. So as many of you know, Neely, which is the Chicago Institute for Women's Learning Program, is an incredible program in its very infant stages. It was only a couple years ago that we sort of came up with the idea of there's so many women in the community who are interested in learning in different kinds of ways, classes, programs, all different kind of formats, and wouldn't it be great if the YU COLO can bring all of this to us, to our homes, to our schools, to places like the Wi-Fi, and bring it home so that we can continue our learning. It's an opportunity for women to engage, challenge, and inspire us through all of their classes and programs, and it's such an honor to be a very, very small part of it, to make it happen. And some of the programs that that Neely has already been has planned for the year, we do Shabbat afternoon shiurim in Skokie, monthly shiurim with Lynn Kraft, who we're going to hear from today, Ginol, which is for the teenagers, women's halakha series, women's Tanakh and Talmud shiurim, the Okner Bat Mitzvah program, monthly Shabbos programs, at Kins, monthly programs in Buffalo Grove and Northbrook, Yarchei Kala in the summer, Mother's Day morning program, and today Women's Health Forum, just to name a few. So it's really, thank you, it's really incredible. And I think what's really wonderful is that it's no one behind a desk sitting and making all of these ideas. The ideas are coming from each one of us, and everybody involved with Neely is really open to hearing any of your thoughts, your suggestions, any program ideas. Please feel free to contact me, my co-chair, Jessica Weiss, any of the staff members, or anyone you might know who's involved with Neely. We're always happy to bring everything that you're interested in and making it work and make it a successful program like today. Some upcoming programs that I just wanted to tell you about is January 14th, this Tuesday, is the night. Wherever you may live, there is a YU COLO Neely program going on. So Tuesday night, 8 to 9 o'clock at the home of Shira Gordon in Lincolnwood, Lynn Kraft is going to be presenting her Women's Monthly Learning Program. The topic is Therein Lies the Wisdom of the Wise, Eitz Chaim He, a Mere Metaphor, a real Replacement. January 14th, again, in the home of the Avners in Northbrook, Opening the Gates, A Deeper Look into Spirituality with Rabbi Mizell, and that is actually a three-week program in Northbrook, the next three Tuesdays, the 14th, 21st, and the 28th. There is also January 14th, if you're in Buffalo Grove, there's another program, Conflict or Confluence. Does Secular Wisdom Have a Place in Judaism with Rabbi Aaron Kraft? Also, this is a great plug to tell any of you, if you haven't yet registered, the annual dinner is coming up Sunday, February 23rd. We will be honoring some of the people who have made incredible contributions to the COLO and to our community. One of our very own, Dr. Shlomo Drapkin and Tammy Drapkin, and Dr. David and Debbie Dopkin, and also we have Mr. Sherwin Greenberg. So February 23rd at the Holiday Inn in Skokie on TUI. It is always an amazing event. It's the only dinner that I've gone to that brings such a diverse community, regardless of your affiliation, regardless of what shul, what school you attended. It's a place just to show your appreciation to the COLO because they do so much for each and every one of us of all ages, our kids, and teenagers and grown-ups as well. Staying Whole, Body and Soul was an idea that was developed sitting at a dining room table coming up with program ideas, and we said, you know, that might be something that works in our community. And look around, it seems to be an idea that really interested all of us, and that's why we're here today. So we really want to thank a few people that made today possible. One is our own Kayla Eisenberg, who has put so much effort into making today happen. Thank you very much. And our co-chairs, Wendy Margolin and Alyssa Weisberg, we want to thank you for all of your hard work and efforts and for inspiring us today. And again, our fabulous speakers who Wendy will introduce you to. We can't wait to start the program, hear what they have to say. And again, thank you all so very much for coming. And please come to me afterwards if there are any comments, thoughts, or any program ideas that you might have. Thank you, Wendy.
Okay, good morning. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Tammy. I'm going to introduce both panels of the speakers. We're first doing this spirituality panel, and then we're going to be doing our next panel with the focusing on physical health. And just quickly, just so I could give you some direction about what we hope to accomplish today, I just want to say what motivated me, and I probably could speak for Elisa also, although I didn't ask her about what motivated her to be a part of this, but I could say for me that for years I've been running, and I always have this group of friends. They usually turn out to be my best friends, who we all get together, and every time we see each other in whatever forum, it's always about, it's almost like a VOD, like, you know, how many miles did you do, and when are you going next, and what's your goal, and how are we achieving it, and what are we doing together, and what's the latest cool shirt you got, like, whatever it is. So in the back of my mind, I'm always feeling like, as a Jewish woman, what am I doing spiritually that matches that? You know, I've got so much time and energy and thought and support going into this physical health, and what's happening on the spiritual side, because really we have to be doing both. And so whether you are really strong at working on your spiritual health, you know, you're always learning or davening, whatever it is, you know, or whether you're really good at getting to your workout class, there's sort of a model here where you can take from one side and bring that energy and that strength that you have on that one side and bring it to the other side. So I think that's what this is about today, finding that balance in our busy lives as Jewish women to make sure that we're focusing on both. And the fact that we're here under the YU Kola, such a reputable organization, shows that really it's all one and the same, that when you're working on your spiritual health, you can also be helping your physical body by just, like, easing stress. And when you're working on your physical health, you're helping your spiritual health by, you know, the same way. So I hope that we go through a lot of topics here, a lot of ideas. I hope everyone can, I think you'll all find something that you can gain, something that you'll learn, or just something to feel empowered about that you could take away from this. So that's really the goal. And we've got great two panels here. We're going to go through, each person is going to speak about what their focus is, why they're passionate about it, what it means to them. And then we're going to have a Q&A where we've given you all, as you see, note cards and pencils. Elisa's going to go around and she's going to read out your questions, and it should be good. So I'm going to introduce first, we have Lynn Kraft, who was so nice to be a part of our program. She was supposed to be here, but thank God they had a family bris, so she was able to go there out of town, and she still came here over FaceTime. So so Lynn is going to go first, and then we'll let her go so we don't have to keep bothering her on the screen. But okay, so Lynn Kraft teaches Chumash at Eid Crown, where I also work, so I get to work with her. She gives a monthly share for women as part of Neely. As you heard, there's one this week. She previously taught at Mayanot Yeshiva High School in Teaneck and in Mechlelet Mevaseret Yerushalayim and Shalavim in Jerusalem and the Stella K. Abraham High School for Girls in Hewlett, New York. She helped pioneer YU's Israel Kola Midrashia, okay, excuse me, an advanced learning program for women in Jerusalem. And she also delivered weekly shiurim for women in Columbia Barnard Hillel and at Congregation Ahavat Torah in Englewood. She's taught a lot of Torah. she has a BA in Judaic Studies and Psychology from Stern, an MA in Bible from the Bernard Revel Graduate School. And her husband, Rabbi Aaron Kraft, is the Rosh Kabura of the YU Talmud Tzion Kollel. And doesn't say, but they just got here this year. So if you haven't met her yet, welcome her. And Aliza Rosenbaum, a teacher at Hillel Torah, and she grew up in Chicago. She attended Hillel Torah and Ida Crown. She went on to learn at Mechlala, and studied performing arts, Judaic studies, and English literature at Stern. She has a master's in Jewish education from Azrieli. And she interned and taught for 2 years in New York and is now in her third year teaching Chumash and Tefillah at Hillel Torah. She and her husband, Rabbi Menachem Rosenbaum, was also from the Kollel. Okay, and their two children are thrilled to be in Chicago and have the opportunity to learn and teach and inspire the community. Okay, last we have Tammy Drapkin is a Kollel teacher for Daughters of Israel. And she is a native Chicagoan and attended Hillel Torah and Ida Crown. We have a lot of Ida Crown representation here in Hillel Torah. She continued her studies at Mechlala and Stern College for Women. I think that was all three of you, right? Okay. That was not intentional. She earned her master's degree in English childhood special ed from Bank Street College of Education. She taught at Bernard Horch JCC and continues to substitute there periodically. Mm-hmm. I think that's how I first met you.
Yeah, probably.
Okay, probably. And 7 years ago, she started her training to be a Kollel teacher through Daughters of Israel. And that's a community organization that promotes and educates about Taharas Mishpacha. And since then, she has been teaching Kollels and helping women find answers to questions regarding mikvah and Taharat Mishpacha. She lives in Skokie with her husband, Shlomo, and her four children.
Thank you.
Okay.
Not answering.
I think you could press decline, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Lynn, hit it.
Hi, everyone. I can't see you, but I'll talk to you anyway. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. I found it interesting that I'm the only one on this spiritual health panel that's actually speaking about a chiyuv, an obligation that we as women have. Right, Elisa is going to be speaking about tefillah, which we all have an obligation to daven at least something, at least once a day. Tammy is going to be speaking about Tara HaMishpacha, which we are all impacted by. The truth is, whether we're married or not, you know, all women are definitely impacted by Tara HaMishpacha, and certainly married women have a chiyuv to be involved in it, you know, almost every day of their lives. Talmud Torah, however, we all know, is really not a chiyuv for women at all. It's a chiyuv for men. Women don't have any obligation whatsoever. However, I really strongly believe that as modern-day women, Torah learning is as relevant today for us specifically as women as ever. And perhaps it's because we're living today, because we're living in the modern world, when we're expected to get the same level, to achieve really the same level of education as men, and we're expected to have the same demanding careers as men, and we're exposed to all the wonders of what a secular education has to offer. And I think that specifically because of that, and this isn't even my idea, I think that this is actually the Chafetz Chaim's idea, which is why he gave, you know, permission to the girls in Beit Yaakov to learn Torah, but because we're exposed to all the wonders of the secular world, that we should be involving ourselves in Torah, that we should realize that our own source of wisdom, right, that the Jewish source of wisdom has the same to offer us, if not more. And I think that that's really, to me, what is the most important aspect of Torah learning for women, even though, you know, it's not a chiyuv, but today I think that we have that, not obligation, obviously, but that real need to learn, just, you know, in a different way, obviously, than the men do, but in a very real way. As, you know, Wendy already told you, I teach Tanakh to high school students and to women, and I do it because I love it. I'm one of those fortunate people that, you know, was able to do something that she loves. And, you know, one of the reasons why I started to become so involved in Torah learning and teaching, etc., was because I love the intellectual challenge you gave me. I know not everyone thinks that way and likes that, but I, you know, personally always loved, I'm a math and science person, I always loved the challenge that it brought me in high school and college, etc. And I just thought that it was amazing that I could get the same kind of challenge from Torah, that something that Hashem wrote so many years ago still has that ability to, you know, make us wonder and make us, you know, try, you know, really motivate us to crack its code and try to decipher what every single word means. You know, there's a Beis Halevi, a very famous one that I once learned that I think puts it very well. The Beis Halevi asks a very good question. why did Hashem give us the Torah as something that was hard for us to understand? Why couldn't he just give it to us on a silver platter, as Levi Salibi asks? Why couldn't it just be like a novel that we read today? You know, you pick it up, you read it, you understand it, you enjoy it, you put it down, and you know everything. And Levi Salibi says that the reason why Hashem chose not to give it to us on a silver platter is because, you know, we may enjoy reading a novel, but in the end of the day, a few days later, we may forget what it says. We may remember the general plot line, but all the little details might go in one ear and out the other. Learning, he says, is very different. Learning requires effort. Learning requires an investment, right? Learning requires us to really sit and pore over every single word. As opposed to just lying on our couch and reading, it's something that requires, like I said, our effort and and once we put in that effort and investment, it sticks with us, and it's something that really becomes a part of us. And instead of, can you guys still hear me?
Okay. Yeah.
And instead of just, you know, enjoying what we're reading, we're able to really remember it and even more importantly be affected by it. Which brings me to my second point, because I don't think that the intellectual pursuit is the most important part of Torah learning. In fact, Chazal tell us, lo amidrash ha'ikar, right? The intellectual piece, the learning piece, is not actually the most important part of Torah learning, but rather it's the ma'aseh, it's the action that comes from it. That, you know, learning Torah is great, but if it's just for the intellectual pursuit, if we're just going to enjoy the intellectual challenge and then leave and then forget about what we learned, or remember the intellectual challenge of it, but forget about, you know, applying it to our daily lives, then it, we might as well not have learned at all. Because the whole purpose of Torah learning is really to become a better person, right? For Torah to impact the way that, you know, we grow and what we do, right? We have to learn the halakhot in order to do the right things, and we also are supposed to learn its values so that we can act in the right ways. And that way, our Torah learning really has a greater purpose. And the greater purpose is to enhance our avodah Hashem in all of its aspects. And whereas we may be drawn to the intellectual pursuit of learning, or some of us may not be, the ultimate purpose of Torah learning is really to have it impact our daily lives. Of course, however, you know, this is much easier said than done. As women, we have lots and lots of other obligations in our lives, right? When, you know, it's interesting because if we had the fortunate ability to go to yeshiva day school, then learning Torah was a part of our schedule, just like, you know, math and science and English and history were. So that's kind of easy, you know, like it's part of your day, it's a built day, and you have to do it, and so you do it. And then, you know, you keep on going, but and then life kind of takes over. You have a job, you have families, and there are lots of other demands on our time. And Torah learning, like I said, it's not a cleo, but it kind of just falls to the wayside. So the question that I want to deal with for the last few minutes is, how can we make Torah learning a part of our lives when we have so many other demands on our time? And I'll be honest, you know, I'm paid to do it every day, so I have it a lot easier than everyone else. Mm-hmm. But I do think that it is possible for those of us who are not paid to do it and who don't have it as part of our daily lives already to make it a part of our daily lives. And I think that the way to do that is to start small and to stay focused. I always, you know, tell my students that, you know, if you want to change, you can't just take something on, like this huge thing at once, because you're just, generally, you're just going to give it up, because it's too hard. But if we take baby steps, if we take one little step at a time that we can do, that's not overwhelming, then we can gradually build it up, and it can become a part of our daily lives. And so I think that there are a few questions we can ask ourselves, and as I, you know, mention them, I guess the idea will be to try to think of how to apply it to our lives, because obviously I don't know every single one of your brains and how they work, but I think that the first thing to ask is, if you could learn anything in Judaism, what would you choose to learn, right? If you had a choice, if you could learn anything, what would it be? Would it be something Gemara-oriented? Would it be something Halakha-oriented or Tanakh? Or would it be a topic, right, Jewish philosophy? Or, you know, there are so many things to learn. But what would you want to learn? Would it be a Sefer? Would it be an idea? And that's the first thing to start with, because in order to make Torah learning a part of your life, you have to want to do it. And in order to want it, you have to, you know, you want to choose something that you would like to learn, that you would enjoy, that speaks to you. So that's the first thing. And I think that the second thing to ask yourself is, what is the best way of going about that? What works for you? Do you think that you would do best with, you know, 10 to 15 minutes before you go to bed, just picking up a Sefer or reading something online or listening to a shiur, you know, even on the Kol website or Y Torah, or, you know, there are thousands of websites out there for us now, which is wonderful. Is that the kind of thing that would work for you, to do it just every night, 10 to 15 minutes on your own? Or are you the kind of person who would do better with a chavrusa, right, learning with a friend? Maybe it would be easier for you because you don't want to let that friend down, so you'll actually show up, right? Maybe you can set up a chavrusa with someone once a week. Or maybe it's going to a kol shir once a month or any other shir. You know, it could also be picking up the phone and calling Nicole and saying, you know, I want to learn this topic and this time works for me. Can you help me out? I know that, you know, Tammy before was explaining all, you know, everything that Neely does, and I'm sure that they'd be willing to, I guess I can't really offer their services, but I think I can. I'm sure that they would really be willing to, you know, open themselves up to whatever works for you. So that's the second thing to ask yourself. You know, in what way do you learn best? Do you learn best by yourself? Do you learn best with a partner? Do you learn best, you know, hearing from a teacher, a lecturer, etc.? And I think that the last thing to ask yourself is how to keep it up. Right, sometimes it's easy to start, but it's really hard to keep up, especially, you know, we're in January now, the whole rest of the world is talking about their New Year's resolutions, and they're also talking about how they give them up after 2 weeks, so I think that the whole idea is how to keep our inspiration alive. And I think that that's a really important part of the issue. You know, is it the kind of thing that you need to set a reminder for yourself every night at 10:30, you know, to make sure that you learn before you go to bed? Is it, like I said, you know, making sure that you are involving a friend so that you have this obligation to your friend and you don't want to let her down? Or is it the kind of thing that you know yourself? If you miss one year in the series, you're not going to go back because for whatever reason you think that it's not worth it. So, you know, try to prevent yourself from missing that year. Or if you miss it, involve a friend or a spouse or even a child to remind you to go the next time and to make sure that you're, you know, to help you motivate yourself that really you're not missing anything. Anything that missing one year is not gonna do anything that great that it's worth missing the rest of the year. So I think that those are, you know, three important questions to ask yourself. What are you interested in learning? How are you interested in learning it? And what is the best way to motivate yourself to continue? And I want to add one thing, because there really is something to be said about learning with family members, whether that's with a spouse or a sibling or a parent or a child. I think that there are so many different ways to not even have to leave your home in order to get some Torah learning in. And you know, perhaps it can be introducing a Dvar Halacha at the family dinner table. It can even be, you know, agreeing on an English Sefer, some halachot that, you know, as a family, you together decide that you want to learn. And every meal, you read one paragraph, and it could be in English, so it could be understandable to everyone at all different ages. Perhaps a bedtime ritual can be slightly altered to introduce an age-appropriate dose of learning, you know, before or after you speak about the day, and before or after you say Shema with the kids. Perhaps a shul program can be initiated. This might be outside the home, but perhaps a shul program can be initiated and, you know, started for this now, but for the spring, for a mother-daughter learning as Shabbos gets longer. There are so many different options to involve our family members as well, and I don't want that to, you know, I think that should definitely be taken into the equation. And, you know, just to end, I think that one of the most beautiful things about Talmud Torah is its versatility. You know, one of the struggles that we have with davening is that it's the same text over and over and over. You know, every aspect of Avodah Hashem really comes with its own issues. And more learning, like I said, it's hard to motivate ourselves, especially as women, when it's not a chiyuv. You know, but like I said, I really do think that there is a very important value in learning Torah, especially for involving ourselves in secular learning throughout our day as part of our careers. And I think that what's nice about Torah learning, something that makes it less of a struggle, is its versatility. The fact that Torah learning can be done at home, or, you know, by ourselves, or with a friend, or with a family member. You know, you can choose what you want. Are you a more text-based learner? Are you a more hashkafically oriented learner? Do you like Gemara more, or do you like Chumash more? Or do you like Halacha, or do you like Jewish philosophy? Do you prefer to do things once a month or once a week? And, you know, the list is endless in the ways that you can really cater Torah learning to your own needs and to your own interests. And I hope that, you know, this ability to personalize and this ability to make it our own can really enable Torah learning to feel constantly fresh and inspiring and relevant. So, you know, I want to thank Nicole for enabling me to be a part of this, even though I wasn't physically there. It's really great. Thank God for Apple. I really appreciate Face Finding. And, you know, it's really a pleasure to be a part of the Kollel, you know, through my husband, and it's really, really nice to be a part of the Kollel myself and involved in Neely. And thank you so much for inviting me, and thanks for enabling me to be a part of the program. Have a great rest of the, enjoy the rest of the program.
Thank you. I'm Aliza Rosenbaum. I am here to talk about davening. And I just want to point out something that stood out to me from Wendy's introduction, which was about how sometimes one element of our life, either the physical or the spiritual, is... Sure. Okay. Is this okay? Is this better?
No.
No, it's not. Hello?
No.
I don't know. I'll just talk louder. Okay, so Wendy said sometimes one aspect of our life, either the physical self or the spiritual self, we feel is stronger. And I was thinking as she was talking, you know, it's amazing if you even have one. Because I was talking to somebody before I asked them why they came today, and she said, you know, this topic really spoke to me because I think as women, we often take care of everybody else, and we sometimes forget ourselves, both physically and spiritually. So I think it's amazing that we're all here and taking the time to develop, you know, both aspects of our lives. So I'm talking about davening today, and I feel a little bit strange being up here in front of so many people who could probably tell me so much about davening. One person in the room actually came and was a guest speaker in my classroom about davening, and I learned a lot from her. I invite all of you to also come and join my davening class. But I'll share whatever thoughts I have, and I want to start with my first memory of feeling connected to davening, and that was in middle school. I actually was a really intense davener in middle school. I don't know if any of my classmates remember that, but I remember that. And I remember as I would take my three steps forward for Shemona Esrei when I was in like 7th and 8th grade, I used to close my eyes before Shemona Esrei, and I would take a minute to just think about what I was about to do. And I would imagine that I was walking into the inner room of a palace. And I would imagine, you know, a marble floor, and I would imagine walking forward, and there's this throne there, and I would try to imagine, you know, all the details on this amazing-looking throne, and I would imagine that I was about to have this personal conversation with God. I developed, like, all these specific habits. There's a science to how you close your eyes. If you close your eyes really tight, then it's totally black. And if you close your eyes just a little bit, you could still see the room around you. But if you close your eyes exactly the right amount, then you just see light. And that's what I would try to do. I would try to find that place where I would just see light, and then I would imagine the whole room was filled with light, and it was all emanating from the throne, and I was about to talk to God. Sometimes I would also imagine the view of the world from space. And I would imagine, you know, you could see all the different planets, and then you get closer, and you start to make out, you know, the water and the earth, and then you start to make out continents, and then countries, and then cities, and then people, and zooming in to me. And I would imagine that that was God's view, that on the one hand, God is so powerful and has so many things that he has to think about and deal with, you know, as it were. And yet God is right now focused just on me, and I would try to think about that as I went into davening. God can do anything, and yet God is here and taking a personal interest in my life right now. And looking back at those thoughts that I had in middle school, I'm kind of amazed because I realize now that there are two obligations that the Shulchan Aruch says we're supposed to have in terms of our mindset as we dive into Shemona Esrei. One of them is that we're supposed to have kavana for the words that we're saying. What do these words actually mean? And the other one is that we need to have in mind that we're standing in front of God, we're talking to God. And you sometimes have one without the other. You can understand all the words that you're saying, but forget the fact that you're talking to God, or you could get that you're talking to God, but you don't understand the individual words. And I think that today, I don't know about all of you, but I hear a lot about davening. I hear a lot about people talking about the davening crisis, and you know, we have so much trouble relating to davening. How do we get people more engaged in davening? Schools are talking about it, shuls are talking about it, all these new initiatives. And there's a lot of focus on the words, which is amazing, and I hope I'll be able to talk about that more later on, about how important it is to understand the words that we're saying. But I think the danger in that, at least I find for myself, is that it can get really discouraging because we keep trying to learn about the words of davening, we keep trying to relate to them, and yet every time we sit down and open up a sitter, we think, I know it's not going to be amazing today. I know I'm not going to understand most of the words that I'm saying, and even if I understand them, I'm not going to relate to them. And it feels like we're always failing and we're always disappointing ourselves. And that's no way to approach davening. It makes us very discouraged. But I think that we need to remember this other element of just the fact that we're standing before God, just the fact that we're making time for God in our day, just the fact that we're having a conversation. Somebody, this is a famous story in my family, that somebody asked my brother one time how all of the children in my family turned out so good, which is to be debated. But somebody apparently thought that we all turned out pretty well and asked my brother, you know, how did your parents raise four such great children? And he said, we always had family dinner together.
Tell them who your brother is.
Rabbi Micha Greenland is my brother. He turned out, he's okay. So he said we always had family dinner together. Now, those of you who have experienced family dinner, which I'm sure is all of us, can probably attest to the fact that family dinner is not always this inspired, you know, meaningful conversation infused with, you know, spirituality. But the very fact that you're making time in your day to say, this is my time, this is just for my family. We had a rule when I was growing up that we didn't answer the phone during dinner because this is exclusive. This is just our time for each other. And even if all that we're saying to each other is, pass the chicken, this just makes a statement in the fact that we're making this time and we're having the conversation. And I think that we need to remember that in our conversations with God as well. The very fact that we're making time in our day, whether we're davening Shacharit, Mincha, and Maariv, or whether, you know, it's just that we're saying brachot, or we're saying one Shmona Esrei a day, or, you know, exactly what our obligations are, we'll talk about hopefully also later. But whatever that time is, the very fact that we're having this conversation with God, that we're saying, look, our communication with you is so important. I want to make this time for you. I kind of think of Torah as the time where God communicates with us. Those are messages that, you know, are for all generations where God speaks to us. And this is our time to talk back to God. Are we making time for that? That itself is such an amazing thing that even if we don't understand anything that we're saying, and even if we have a totally uninspired davening on any given day, we should feel great about the fact that we had that conversation, that we talked to God, that we made that time in our day, that we made that statement. And I think that that's something which we should always keep celebrating as we try to, at the same time, work on making it more inspired, work on understanding more of the words. And I hope we can talk more about the specifics through the questions that we asked today.
Okay, it's very hard to speak after two presentations that were just phenomenal. I'm actually still processing, so forgive me. Amazing. So thank you, Lisa. Thank you, Lynn, wherever you are. It was phenomenal. I'm actually very honored to be speaking here today for everybody. My name is Tammy, also. I've been a college teacher for Daughters of Israel for about 6 years, been training for about 7, but teaching for about 6, which means that I'm the one who gets to welcome the new brides into the wonderful world of mikvah and taharat mishpacha. Which is a fabulous opportunity. During the regular challah course, it's usually about 6 classes for about 2 hours apiece, and we spend most of our time on the halachot. That's the details, the nitty-gritty, the what you're supposed to do and when. We, of course, always include one full class, and throughout the classes, tidbits about hashkafa, possible ideas, and different approaches that one can have to this mitzvah. And that's what we're here to discuss today. Just that, some approaches and some ideas of how we can relate to the mitzvah of mikvah and taharat mishpacha spiritually. I heard a beautiful idea about spirituality from Rabbi Brand this year during his Aser Yimei Teshuvah drasha. He quoted Harav Adin Steinsaltz in his book Simple Words. You can ask him where he found the book. I'm pretty sure it was a used bookstore. That's where he finds all his books. If anyone has been to a shiurim, you know that also. In this book, Rav Steinsaltz says that we exist as amphibious beings, which means we exist in two worlds. We exist in the material world, and we exist in the spiritual world. I'm pretty sure that's not a new idea to anyone. But the way he defines it is where the newness comes in. What he says is that the material world is what we would call the real things, the things that we can experience with our senses, what we can see, what we can touch specifically, what we can hear, and what we can smell. These are the things that are real in our real world. The spiritual world, he says, is not the traditional world that we would think of as spiritual. Rather, it consists of things that are very real to us that we cannot touch, such as our thoughts and our emotions. I'm sorry, I love that piece. I think that is so beautiful. These are very real things in our world. We just can't touch them. That is our spiritual existence. Using that beautiful definition of spirituality, I want to discuss some very real thoughts and emotions about Taharat Mishpacha and Mikvah. And I'm just going to keep saying those two things, and hopefully whichever piece you're thinking of will relate to what we're talking about. By training, in addition to being a college teacher teaching the brides, I'm also a nursery school teacher. I'm Aura Tammy is one of my favorite names. When teachers are taught, as Lynn and Lisa can also agree, when you're taught about conducting a parent-teacher conference, you're taught to start by discussing the positive and then moving to the more difficult piece of the conversation. This is also true for any relationship, business, family, professional. You want to start with something nice, and then you want to move to whatever the less nice piece is going to be. Today, I'd actually like to do the opposite. We're going to start with some of the more difficult, challenging aspects of this mitzvah, and then hopefully move to a positive, encouraging, dare I say, inspirational piece that's available out there. Now, I know that everyone here might have their own idea or two of something about this mitzvah that they might find difficult or challenging or possibly frustrating, but I'm going to bring up three specific points that I find the hardest to work through as a kala teacher. The first one is almost obvious. How and when do we learn about this mitzvah? Most women, if they're even having a formal lesson, learn about it right before their wedding, sometime during the engagement. Okay, that's not a good time. Anyone who has been married, planned a wedding, or knows anyone who has ever gotten married knows that this is a very, very busy time. The bride is busy planning a big wedding, possibly a whole weekend or a whole week full of parties. She's picking flowers, band, photographers, I think they're now called photojournalists nowadays, food, music. She's busy thinking about her past and reflecting on her history and planning for her future. And quite honestly, as I talk to these kalas, they really only care about their dress and the boy, so they're just very distracted all over. It's really, and often they're doing this while balancing school, work, or both. So it's really not the best time to learn an entire new mitzvah with tremendous amount of details. And as I have been taught from my teachers, there's actually more written about mikvah and Tahara Mishpacha than Kashrut and Shabbos together. Don't ask me how. Someone told me that. So I choose to believe them. So challenge number one is how and when we learn it. It presents a huge challenge. Number two, this is the only mitzvah that I can think of, and if anyone has another idea, let me know, that we do without ever watching anyone else perform it. We have no one to model it after. The only other example I came up with is the Kohen Gadol in the Kodesh Kodashim on Yom Kippur when he goes in by himself. I'm assuming we don't have anyone here, so this doesn't apply to our group. Other than that, this is really the only time we're busy, involved in something that we haven't watched someone else. If someone is learning to keep Shabbos, they go spend Shabbos with an observant family and they do as they do. If someone's learning to be a moel, they apprentice a moel for quite some time. It's actually true, I would say, about all of our mitzvot. Davening, see, now we can all follow Aliza's fabulous examples. You can only imagine how the astronauts would daven when they actually have the vision. But, like, that's something we can all take with us. She just modeled for us an idea we can take with us. Keeping a kosher kitchen, lighting Shabbos candles. I would even say giving tzedakah, hachnasat orachim, and bikur cholim fall into this category also. As I look at Tammy Miller, who has a whole bikur cholim program. Just a plug, sorry, Tammy. But anything we do, we can watch someone else do it and imitate what we saw. That is not the case for mikvah. So challenge number two is that we have no one to model. And number three, innate in the design of this mitzvah is that we women are supposed to talk to a man, and not just any man, a rabbi, about the most private aspects of our lives. Going to the bathroom, intimacy, and when I say intimacy, I'm actually specifically talking about sex, and having our periods. I don't think any more explanation is necessary for why this is challenge number three. We're done. Okay, now that I have us all running for the door, myself included, today's goal is actually to inspire us. So let's move, now it's time to move to the positive, okay? Challenge number one, how and when we learn it. This is going to feed off a lot of what Lynn Kraft said about Limud Torah, okay? What everyone needs to know is that standing under the chuppah does not make anyone an expert. A woman is just a beginner then. The process of learning all the details and the practices is continuous from the minute she gets married throughout her married life. We expand our knowledge as life experience gives us opportunities for learning and growth. I want to compare it to a beginner chess player versus the expert chess player. The beginner chess player is just learning the names of the pieces and figuring out which way they move. That is the newly married bride, a beginner, figuring out first how to count 5 or 7 days, what's really a day on that Jewish calendar, where is the mikvah, when is it open, and what is that special code or word to get in? I can't remember. Okay? That's the beginner. The expert player has learned many strategies and is always a few steps ahead in the game. This is the more experienced married woman, already able to tell a difference maybe between a red stain and a brown stain, knowing exactly when Shkia is in the summertime and the wintertime, and certainly knowing which room at the mikveh has the best water pressure. This comes from experience. My bubby knew that beginners need to learn. When I got married, she gave me a cookbook, God bless her, out of my yes dream, and wrote on the, I just found it today, it was the back cover, said, "To the girl who can't make cauliflower, love ya." Okay, what was she referring to? She was referring to my first attempts at cooking when I was a beginner, when I tried to steam cauliflower. Okay, I tried to steam cauliflower in the microwave. I took the cauliflower, I put it in a bowl, and I put it in the microwave. I left out the water. She thought that was the funniest thing ever, but it makes so much sense. I was a beginner. I was learning the basics. Over time, as I spent more time cooking, I have certainly improved quite a bit. Definitely not an expert, but I do always add water when I'm trying to steam cauliflower now. So beginners need time to be exposed to and opportunities to experience the many, many intricacies of Taharat Mishpacha. But there are two things to keep in mind on this journey. We are often doing it at most, or maybe around usually, at most 12 times a year. That's not a lot. So it takes months and it takes years to develop our strategies and to be comfortable. And remember, life changes can send us right back to the beginning. It's kind of like, you know, head back to start. Whether it be having babies, bodily changes, stress in our life changes, there are many things that send us back to the beginning status, in which case there are new factors to consider. So this, again, will lengthen our learning process. So really, I feel it's very important for every woman to be patient and realize that it is a constant learning process. Now, I do think God has a fairly good sense of humor, as just as we're finally experts, menopause sets in, but that's for another discussion. Okay? I do want to share a story with you that Talia Zizek, who happens to be Elisa's sister, shared with me. It's a beautiful story. She heard it from Rav Tani Cohn, who was quoting Rav Kamenetsky. Everyone got that? So it's like fourth hand already. But Rav Kamenetsky described a young boy getting his first pair of tzitzit. He is being welcomed into the fold. He is starting a new mitzvah. Everyone's so proud of him. We decorate it with an Aleph Bet train, and we make it all colorful, and we teach him how to move it out of the way in the bathroom, and we're just so excited, and everyone's so excited that he's wearing his new pair of tzitzit, and he walks into kindergarten, and he shows his mora, and we try not to lose the, you know, all 10 pairs, because that's what they do. It's amazing. He's starting the new mitzvah. He's welcomed in, tons of enthusiasm. What would happen if he came to his bar mitzvah and he was wearing that same pair of tzitzit? If he was still wearing that small pair of tzitzit from when he was 3 years old? We'd be a little concerned. Because we would see that although he's still involved in the same mitzvah, his understanding of it and the way he practiced it never grew with him. So we need to remember that in our observance of mikvah and Taharat Mishpacha, or really any mitzvah, as we grow, we need to update and adjust our understanding of the mitzvah to match our personal growth. It's a very moving story. Tell Talia, because I'll let her know. Okay, so if we need to update our growth, this leads us to challenge number two. How can we learn more if we have no one to model it? Well, Lynn Craft just gave us a beautiful answer. Let's go learn. And that's pretty much my same answer. But before I get to that, I want to give a slightly possible other option. The other option is to actually see that as a benefit, as a positive. Because if we're watching someone else for our mitzvah observance, it's possible, I'm not saying it is, it's a possibility that our sincerity can be compromised. How do I mean? And you'll let me know if you like this example of davening. If we're watching someone daven, and they're shuckling at like 3 miles per hour, and I decide I want to be more religious or feel more religious, then I could decide to shuckle at 5 miles per hour. Or if I see them shuckling at 3 miles per hour, and I decide I don't really want to be quite that religious, I'm only going to shuckle at 1 mile per hour, you know, obviously that is drastically missing the point of davening and actually can distort the beauty of the mitzvah. Sometimes watching someone else perform a mitzvah can get in the way of our sincerest motives. So because we haven't directly observed anyone in mikvah or tafel mishpacha, our knowledge of it is actually very close to the original source, and it is possible that our performance of it might be in its purest form. So that's one way to think of that lack of model. A second suggestion is just finding an alternative for getting the information, and that can come in lots of different forms. Certainly Limud Torah, certainly the continuing classes, and I would dare say even talking to friends about it in an appropriate way. I don't think this should be conversation at the Shabbos table. But I do think if you have a dear friend or you have a question or you have something you want to know, there are people available to talk about. And information is really helpful. I just have to share a really funny story with you. I was talking to a friend of mine, and we were talking about bidikos. I don't know why. Maybe if you're a college teacher, that's what you talk about with your friends. But we were talking about it, and in it, she mentioned that she flushes her bidika cloth down the toilet. So I interrupted her, and I said, "What? You flush them down the toilet?" And she said back to me with the same befuddled tone, "Of course. What do you do?" I said, "Well, it's cotton. It goes in the garbage." She was shocked. She had never heard of that. Okay. Well, we were equally disturbed by each other's practices. I had to find out more. So I started asking my close friends who wouldn't think I was a nut or who would think I was a nut but are nice enough to love me anyway. What do you do with your bidika cloths? Do you flush them or do you toss them? From my very unscientific research, I found out there are two camps, the flushers and the tossers, and they are equally appalled by the other's practice. I don't think the Shulchan Aruch has a comment on this, okay? But the divergence, I believe, comes from the fact that none of us have watched someone else toss or flush, which is a great thing. I'm just saying there's no one to model. So, and of course, I'm assuming it's a good bidika, it doesn't need to be brought in, there's no question about it. We're talking about the bidikas that we're done with and don't need to be taken care of. So for challenge number two, the answer is, as Lynn Kraft said, we should learn it any way we can. Learn. Buy books, go to classes, go online. As everyone else has said, call the COLA and tell them you want another program. Any way you can find the information, it's there for you. You deserve it. Just a word about refresher courses. I feel obligated. I've shared this with many of the kalas that I've taught, who some of them are here, and it just, you have no idea how it elevates me to see you here. So thank you. There are refresher courses, but I have to tell you how I used to think about refresher courses. When I go back to when I was married, within my first 5 years, there were always refresher courses around, and I got to tell you, they scared the daylights out of me. I didn't like them, because if I went to them, I was either told everything that I already know, because, I'm doing it so perfectly, which was a waste of my time, or it was going to tell me I was doing it wrong, or they were going to teach me something new. And, what was I supposed to do with that? I was doing it wrong for all this time, and I couldn't handle that maybe I was doing it wrong. And that really scared me. So I never enjoyed the refresher courses, but I'd like to fast forward now 10 years in my life. The experience of going to a class and learning more is the exact reason I actually became a college teacher. When I was in graduate school, we learned that most people become teachers either because they had a horrible teacher and they want to compensate for it, or because they had an amazing teacher and they want to pay back and be great and they want to imitate it and emulate that teacher. I did have a phenomenal college teacher myself, but I was sold on teaching college when I went to my first training class. I sat around a table with other women who were there to train, and we had the most open, amazing, supportive conversation about using the mikvah and Taharat Mishpacha. It was validating. It was freeing. It was invigorating. I loved hearing that other women ran into the same concerns as me, or had the same questions as me, or laughed about the same thing as me. It was super encouraging to realize I was not alone. And I'm telling you, this took at least 10 years into my marriage, which is a very long time to feel alone when you're doing a mitzvah. This feeling of not feeling alone, maybe some of you have had this experience. It also comes over me when I'm in Israel at the pharmacy. When you're there buying your lice comb or your anti-lice spray, whichever one you're getting at the time, you walk past the display of bidika cloths. And you're like, whoa, this is really cool. There must be a lot of women using them if they're selling them at the pharmacy. I could only, wouldn't that be something if Jewel started carrying them in the kosher aisle? That would be fabulous. I don't know if our husbands would go pick those up for us, but still, they would be available, something to work on. The point is that we really have no model and no one to follow. We know other women are doing it. There are tons of resources out there for us to learn, and this brings us to challenge number three. Rabbis. Okay. There is no way for me to convince you that talking to a rabbi on this topic is normal. I'm not going to. But what I am going to tell you is that they're really, really nice. Okay? They have hours and hours and years of halachic experience in Taharat Mishpacha, and they can't use it without us. They have learned all the details of this halacha so that we have access to it. The only way we can get it is by asking them. It has happened often that something has come up. A woman had a situation where she was at her wit's end. It was really tough on her emotionally, and I urged her. I said, it's a good idea to call her up. Once she became brave, and I will absolutely use that word because you have to be really brave to call a Rav, I always get the phone call of how shocked she was and how easy it was, how kind he was, how her she got her answer, and that made her feel fabulous. He was so easy to talk to. The rabbis are not scared or horrified by her questions. They're not even shocked. They're trained professionals eager to help. So, again, I'm not a fool. I'm pretty sure everyone here is as eager to call a rabbi as my kallahs are, which is not at all. So I offer you an alternative. The alternative is that there are women in our community who are willing to help. For whatever odd reason, myself included, we are comfortable asking a rabbi a question for you. You can call us. You can email us. We will get you the answer. The kollel, actually, after this beautiful morning, will be sending out a follow-up email with the names and numbers of some of the women who are available. There are many more, but we're going to, as Lynn said, start in small steps. There are women available. You should feel free to use them. I urge you to make the training of these women worthwhile, and I certainly urge you to make the rabbis work harder. I've been told that's what they want to do. That's what I've been told. So here's my favorite, I'm almost done. So here's my favorite line to the kallahs, okay? Which is what I try to sell them. Once a woman is putting in her time, effort, and energy for this mitzvah, she deserves to have as much accurate information as possible. This is her mitzvah. It is her right to be well-educated and informed in her mitzvah observance. It is so much better for a woman to feel comfortable and confident with what she is doing instead of nervous and ambivalent. If a woman goes to the mikvah hesitant, unsure, or even confused, how comfortable will she be when she comes home afterwards? Those feelings can absolutely affect the entire relationship and miss the entire goal of the mitzvah. So again, it is every woman's right to have a much more accurate information for any mitzvah, not just this one, for all mitzvot as possible. There are many sources for information. The rabbis are a fabulous one, but it's based on your preference. There are also women available to help. So I just want to mention something here that was said by Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartzschlita of our own CRC. He points out that he thinks it's very important for a woman to feel that her femininity is being protected. So he liked to make the point that anonymous questions or questions asked via another woman are perfectly valid. So I know that you all think I'm crazy, and this is the part of the kallah class where my kallahs sort of tilt their head, kind of stare at me like a deer in headlights, and they're like, kind of like most of you are looking at me right now, like no, I'm not doing it, but I'm telling you the truth. They're very nice people. The rabbis are very nice people. They have tremendous amounts of knowledge and experience. And their highest concern, and this is what almost every rabbi I speak to will say to me, their highest concern is the woman, her husband, and the couple. Again, I could go on for a long time. Remember, I usually fill up 12 hours of talking. But to summarize, basically, there are a few obstacles we need to be mindful of while being involved in Taharat Mishpacha. We have formal classes at a timing that's not ideal. We are starting to do a new mitzvah, and we've never watched anyone else do it. It has not been modeled for us, and we are asked to speak to someone, whether it be even a rabbi or even another woman, about some of the most private parts of our lives. However, I hope we all now know that like most everything else we do, learning is a process. We grow over time. We can make use of all the many resources available to us, and by internalizing these ideas, I certainly hope that our thoughts and our emotions, our spiritual world of mikvah and Taharat Mishpacha is a more positive one. Thank you. Wendy, who's next? Oh, we're done. Oh, are we doing questions?
Okay, thank you so much. Everyone spoke beautifully. We're just going to take like a 2-minute break. If somebody has to go to the bathroom or you want to grab more food, there's plenty, so please do it while our panels switch. And we're going to do one Q&A at the end of our next panel. Okay. Yes, you can write your questions, go to the bathroom, get a drink, whatever. We'll resume with our next.
Yeah, every college class that I've ever